and welcome to Background Briefing about the 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.com. Today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the embarrassing amateurism on display with Trump's train wreck leadership now being normalized as being an unorthodox way of doing business. Meanwhile, it is increasingly clear that Trump hates meetings like the G7 because he is unable to keep up with his peers without looking foolish and exposing his ignorance. And having purged those few top White House advisers who tried to speak truth to power, we now have a team of sycophants, lightweights, cranks, and crackpots surrounding a woefully unqualified president who has to resort to reality TV spectacle to disguise his incompetence and inability to govern in an executive branch unable to implement policies and enact promises. Kent Harrington, a former CIA analyst who served as National Intelligence Officer for East Asia, joins us to discuss the staged-for-TV Singapore Summit, which late-night TV hosts have likened to a TV reality show, The Bachelorette. And now that the only adult left in the Trump cabinet who is not a sycophant or a toady, Defense Secretary Mattis, has been blindsided by promises to stop exercises and pull troops out of South Korea, we'll examine whether there is a capacity in this administration to follow through on the opening Trump has claimed his wildly successful summit has provided. Then, with a white supremacist sympathizer running as the Republican nominee for the U.S. Senate in Virginia, a wife-beating Democrat running for the House in South Carolina, and a pimp running as Republican for the state legislature in Nevada, we'll assess the meanness and madness in Trump's America that will escalate as the November elections approach. With Republican Senator Corker describing his Republican Party as having become, quote, a cult-like situation under Trump, we'll speak with Mike Loughran, the author of the bestseller, The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. Then finally, we will discuss the $85.4 billion mega-merger between AT&T and Time Warner, which was approved on Tuesday in full by the federal judge, Richard Leon, in defiance of the Justice Department. With 50,000 mergers having taken place in 2016 and 50,000 in 2017, and $2 trillion spent on mergers so far in 2018, we will speak with Jesse Eisinger, a Pulitzer Prize-winning senior reporter for ProPublica, who covers Wall Street and finance, about this new laissez-faire business environment in which antitrust tools are not being used. And joining us now is Kent Harrington, a former senior CIA analyst who served as National Intelligence Officer for East Asia and Chief of Station in Asia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kent Harrington.
Thank you, Ian. Good afternoon to you.
Well, thank you for joining us, Kent. And obviously, from the introduction, you can see that I was somewhat unimpressed by the summit, although I must say it was extraordinary to watch. It was really was like a TV reality show. I kept thinking, looking at Kim Jong-un, there was this kind of bemused look on his face that the whole thing had an unreal quality to it. But I'm sort of divided. On the one hand, maybe it takes a kind of ego-driven amateur to break through. And let's face it, for you know, several decades, the professionals haven't been able to do anything. So not that it's a done deal, but at least he's got an opening. So how do you sort of, you know, balance that, the skepticism about Trump's kind of reality TV approach to international relations and the possibility that, you know, nothing has worked so far, so why not give this a chance?
Well, Ian, you're in Los Angeles and I'm not, and you've just characterized what sounds to me like a wonderful pitch for a series, an ego-driven amateur who breaks through decades, if not centuries, of divisions and brings about a tremendous change in relations on the Korean Peninsula, staving off nuclear war and bringing peace in our time. I'd sign you up for the next season. Unfortunately, Trump's approach is a great deal like what you've just described, and it seems to me the way in which we've watched it unfold has a lot to do with his own essential training as a media celebrity, having moved from his real estate empire into the world of marketing Trump as a brand, that doesn't necessarily bring the kind of results that a 14 or 15 episode series might, if you can manage every dimension on a Hollywood set or a New York set for a reality show. Let's go back and take a quick look at why history matters. This was a coming out party for Kim Jong-un, the third in a line of Kim dynasty leaders who have essentially led the world's now most repressive regime for the better part of 70 years. If you think about what that means, if you think about someone who was flown to Singapore on a Chinese aircraft because of the inability of the regime to produce its own airworthy transportation from Pyongyang to Singapore, if you think about a regime that couldn't pay the hotel bill for Kim at one of the finer hotels, to be sure, in Singapore. If you think about someone who's only traveled abroad as a student and then a few trips to China since taking power from his father several years ago, if you think about the pomp and the circumstance, the media that surrounded this event, it's a little bit like, or perhaps a lot like, a prom or a coming out party in which everyone else footed the bill. And if you're Kim, what's not to enjoy? Let's look at the substance, however, and it seems to me the substance falls dramatically short of what any American president or any administration or anyone who looked closely at developments in Korea would want to see from a Western point of view. We have a communique that is basically vacuous. We have nothing that even remotely approaches the specific policy positions that not only the Trump administration, but in many cases, several previous administrations have demanded in order to bring the North Koreans to the table to talk seriously about the verifiable reduction in their nuclear arsenal and the application of arms control, even if not disarmament, on the Korean Peninsula to bring stability in a region that, from the viewpoint of the most important destabilizing power, North Korea, it frankly desperately needs. We have nothing in the future negotiations that suggest we have on the table a set of goals or objectives that the North Koreans and the United States have agreed upon as subjects for discussion. We have the North Koreans repeating their boilerplate used over almost 30 years to describe their commitment to quote-unquote denuclearization violated at every turn. This isn't to say that the wheel can't itself turn, that Kim can't be different than his father and his grandfather. But at this point, if I were going to assess the balance sheet on this summit, set aside the TV critics' view of how well it played and what the ratings were, I would simply say that Kim can go home having achieved virtually every objective he had for his first appearance in the limelight, under the Klieg lights on the world stage. And Trump returns having abandoned his own, admittedly in several cases, utterly unrealistic demands of North Korea, but also abandoned many of the core elements of the American policy position vis-a-vis North Korea in Asia that are absolutely fundamental to reassuring our allies, maintaining stability, and ultimately bringing over the long term, and that's the only way the game is played internationally in an arena such as the one we're witnessing in Asia, over the long term, to bring about a Korea where we do not have a potentially destabilizing nuclear armed power menacing not only South Korea, but the stability of the region.
And again, I'm speaking with Kent Harrington, who's a former senior CIA analyst who served as National Intelligence Officer for East Asia and Chief of Station in Asia. What about then the idea that Trump is surrounded by sycophants and toadies and amateurs, and some of them, like Navarro, are sort of cranks and crackpots. And the only adult around left, I think pretty much this chief of staff is finished. Others have been purged who've tried to speak truth to power. You've only got Mattis left, and Mattis got totally blindsided by Trump's statement that the joint exercises between the U.S. and South Korea were provocative and that he wants to pull troops out. So if Mattis has been marginalized, Where are the adults, even in terms of the South Koreans and maybe the Chinese? Is there anybody else? Because Trump seems to basically be on a roll here and feels like he's the decision maker. I recall George W. Bush used to say, "I'm the decider." But I don't think Bush worked with a competent cabinet, and he worked with the government itself. But Trump has basically stripped the government. The State Department has been hollowed out, and it doesn't seem like he takes any interest in or doesn't listen to the professionals, particularly somebody as seasoned as Secretary of Defense Mattis.
Well, I think you put your finger on something that ought to be a worry and get much more attention and coverage by the media than it does today, and that is the thinness of the bench and the uncertain quality of those who are in the immediate circle surrounding Trump. To be sure, there's been a great deal written about Trump being Trump, having either driven out or weeded out or forced out in some form or fashion people around him who might have been a leavening influence on his behavior. And the White House under Trump is one that is obviously reflecting his personality and his character. But the important thing, it seems to me, to look at is exactly what your observations allude to, and that is the competence of the administration to manage not only policies that serve goals it wants to achieve, but the consequences of acts that it takes, which play out in ways that are often, understandably, in a global environment we don't control, unintended. In the wake of this summit, for example, with the people surrounding him, who I think you've reasonably accurately described as those who aren't going to challenge, quote-unquote, the boss, are we going to be capable of dealing with the ricochet, the rebound, the unexpected results of a meeting in Singapore that at the end of the day leaves open almost every, if not every, question that is important to the resolution of the North Korean nuclear issue? If we look at the consequences of the summit, the question that comes immediately to my mind is, quote, unquote, is this the best they can do? If it is, if this vague declaration of intentions, if the undefined agenda that appears to be the result of the discussions in Singapore are the best this administration can produce, having prepared for months, having made North Korea its primary foreign policy and national security concern, having threatened war over the issue. If this is the best we can do, how can we be confident that the team around Trump is not only capable of carrying through with its policies, but of dealing with the unintended consequences of its actions? I, for one, am concerned that you're looking at an administration that, just as you suggested a moment ago, has marginalized people that are going to raise the tough questions, that are going to say, maybe we need to build a broader consensus. Maybe the Japanese are right. Maybe the Europeans are right. Maybe we need to have a kind of alliance to deal with Kim that we don't have now. Maybe simply turning to the Chinese, who obviously have been Kim's support and sustenance, isn't going to be the way to open the door to a resolution. Who's going to say that to Trump? I don't see it in Pompeo, who's obviously got his sycophantic qualities that have been displayed on numerous occasions. I don't certainly see it in Bolton, who seems to be having a difficult time getting into the Oval Office with views that are much more hardline than Trump at this moment seems to want to entertain. I don't see it in the other cabinet secretaries who have an important role to play because of their economic portfolios that are going to be directly affected by conflict, not only with our potential adversaries, but also with our allies. So the question you raise, where do we go next if this is a White House that is basically nothing more than a l'état-c'est-moi, I am the center of the universe, I'm going to play this as if it's my television show with tomorrow's episode being determined by what I think tonight, where are we going to go with an issue that, frankly, is far more complex, far more difficult than Trump with his bromance relationship with Kim on the front page has presented to the American people and the world.
Well, the thing that's most frightening of all, though, is that so far we have not had a crisis, something that comes out of the blue. And this happens with every president. They're faced with a crisis. And so far we've been lucky. And that's so I think you have to add that dimension to it, don't you? That, you know, this is a train wreck under normal circumstances. But my God, if the pressure's on, how do you think they're going to behave?
Well, you've gone to the most worrisome dimension to the problem, and obviously crises of the sort that you're alluding to aren't predictable, or they wouldn't be crises, right? So, from the viewpoint of how Trump will behave in extremis, when walking through the options and the alternatives, and being able to measure the risks versus the benefits of acting one way or another, is absolutely crucial to the leader of the country. I, too, like you, have grave concerns. Take as a case in point something that appears on the surface, perhaps, to many people, and for understandable reasons, to be a kind of easy negotiating position. Trump's decision, apparently without consultation with his own military leadership in Korea or in Washington, to offer up to Kim the preemptive concession of suspending U.S. military exercises, as well as characterizing them in basically North Korean, Chinese, and Russian terms as quote-unquote provocatives, when in fact they're defensive military exercises designed to deal with a potential North Korean attack on the South, for which Pyongyang is quite well postured. When Trump gives that up and says, we're giving up something that really doesn't matter, quote-unquote war games, that's the implication, that we could do this or not do it and it doesn't matter. It betrays a fundamental misunderstanding of what exercises are all about. Military forces exercise because it's the only way they can test operationally whether their plans for a conflict, the onset of which, by the way, militaries can't necessarily predict, are going to be operationally appropriate and effective. The need for exercises grows in importance because of the need to coordinate with allies. For example, our allies in South Korea, who speak a different language, who may use the same equipment, who may operate from the same war plans that we do, but who still are a different kind of force with different leadership. And our ability to work effectively with them depends on literally practicing exactly that. Add another complicated layer, and that is the role of technology, which doesn't necessarily simplify how you push the button and go to war if you must. And you're witnessing a president who is not only making a political faux pas, a negotiating mistake, but who is suggesting, by the way, he's dealing with this issue of the capability of our forces to operate effectively in Korea, dealing with it as if it's a throwaway when it is anything but. Am I arguing that we should never change our posture in Korea, that we should never make concessions of this sort? Absolutely not. But this is an absolutely critical dimension to the way in which U.S. forces in Korea interface with and operate on their own on that territory. And it's a very, very troubling example of someone who admits quite publicly he doesn't need to prepare and betrays in the act that he takes an extraordinary, I'll use the term ignorance, of what the role of U.S. forces is in concert with their allies, amounts to on the Korean Peninsula.
Well, Kent Harrington, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's a pleasure, Ian. Very good to talk to you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Kent Harrington, who is a former senior CIA analyst who served as National Intelligence Officer for East Asia and as Chief of Station in Asia. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with Republican Senator Corker describing the Republican Party as having become a cult-like situation under President Trump. We'll be looking into the meanness and madness in Trump's America that will escalate as the November elections approach.